with and without electrons and muons. So our full Lagrangian was, we start off with minus 1/4 f mu nu, minus, I can't remember what I was using for the variables here. So psi bar, I think d slash plus me psi. Do you remember what symbol I was using for the muon? Was that chi? Chi, okay. And then I had a, I'm going to put in a coupling here, E naught A mu J mu. I didn't have this E here, but I want to put it back in just to make a point. So you could have, previously you could imagine that E was hidden inside the current. And these, remember, these are the classical currents that are charge distributions or the things you would have done as an undergraduate thinking about classical electromagnetism, where you would have had this term and this term. And then we're also imagining we following the electrons and the muons, and mostly we're going to start off with, we were just following electrons and we weren't really worried about muons, but I'm going to bring them back in a second to make a point. And so we went through the exercise of asking what would the, after, at energies below the electron and muon mass, so the muon mass, remember, is so the muon mass is something like 100 MeV, it's 100 and something, 120 or something. And the electron mass is a little bit less than, so it's like half an MeV. So imagine that we're much at energies much lower than that, which we typically are for classical electromagnetism. Then we imagine writing down the effective Lagrangian. So for E much less than electron mass, our Wilson action was minus 1/4 z times f mu nu, and we had all possible things involving f's, which were suppressed by various masses. So we had, I want to use the same letters I used last time. I think I, let me use the same notation. I just make sure I don't lie to you. All right, so we had, we have A over ME squared. And there would also be a term, something over mu squared from integrating out the muon, but I'm not writing that because that's so much smaller than A over ME squared. But it kind of underlines the fact that generically, when you integrate out particles, you get, let me write it once, so let's like AE plus A mu over mu squared times F mu nu, box F mu nu. And we had, I think A prime I called it, I might not have called it this, but I should have called it this. And then we had B continue on this line, we had C over ME squared, ME to the fourth. And we still had this E naught J mu. And here F twiddle is just the dual. And like we could have also had an F dual term, I guess, here. And I didn't write that one down because it was a total derivative. And then these two turned out to be rewritable as A over ME squared minus 2A prime over ME squared times J mu, D mu, J nu, D mu, J nu, because I could simplify them using the equation of motion, and so I could trade them for, if I use the equation of motion, which says that the divergence of F is J, I think of that as a zeroth order Lagrangian, then I could simplify these guys to things involving currents only. So they were redundant interactions in that sense. In real life, J is electrons, but imagine that, think of it as being macroscopic, you know, wires and things like that, that are, as far as we're concerned, at these very low energies, are just sources of charge. And we're not distinguishing the fact that that they really are electrons. We could have, the thing I'm sidestepping there is that I'm treating the electrons, when you do this calculation, you're thinking of the electrons as if they're in their vacuum. And the proper way to do the wire story with electrons would be that they're not in their vacuum. You really are, you're looking at a system where you've got some macroscopic electron number. So you're in the sector, and the electron number is conserved, so you're in the sector of your Hilbert space for which there's a significant and large lepton number, and you're looking for the ground state of that configuration subject to the other things that are going on, like you have a lattice of protons and neutrons in which the wire exists and stuff like that. So there's a complicated state there, and you're looking at a minimum energy configuration for that state, and you're manipulating that state to give you the current you want. And in principle, you could do that right. But in practice, as you'll see later on, we'll do that right. We'll look at systems where the thing being ignored is not in its ground state later. That's one of the later topics. And the leading approximation there is often, but not always, but it's often kind of a mean field thing where you're describing the environment as some sort of classical currents. So this is, I haven't derived that it is, but you can think of this as being an approximation to that complicated story of what the state was that you're really dealing with when you're, they really are electrons, but it's also true they're really not in their vacuum. And this calculation of them, treating them as if they are in the vacuum, the claim is that calculation, looking at quantum fluctuations of electrons about that very complicated state, is being captured by vacuum fluctuations of electrons with these things just regarded as currents that you specify. And they have to satisfy that, as someone asked last time, it has to be conserved, otherwise the thing wouldn't engage invariant under A goes to A plus something. So you're imagining these things are just actually identically conserved. So this would be true if, for example, if I had a static distribution of charges, so that the time derivative of the charge distribution is identically zero, or if you have a distribution of currents for which div J is zero identically, that would be the kind of thing you're specifying. And mostly I'm just keeping it there because if you didn't have that, there's not a lot of physics in this term because it's just free photons. And so I want to track what Z is doing for you. And this is a way of doing that. Okay, so last time I started to go off into what Z was, and it's the dominant. If we kind of ask, so there's several things that you get from this. You know, the points, some of which I made, some of which I might not have made. So one is each of these coefficients has a muon electron contribution, and the electron one wins because the electron mass is lightest. So it's the smallest mass that's winning in these denominators. So the 1 over ME terms dominate the 1 over mu terms. And so when I made statements like in gravity, the curvature cube term should be suppressed by the electron mass and not by the Planck mass, this is the spirit of it. If we had had a whole bunch of particles, we knew what the theory of the world was, we integrate them all out, and we get a coefficient of curvature cubed, in the gravity Lagrangian at low energies, you'll get a 1 over m to whoever you integrate it out, and you'll get a sum of contributions for all the different fields you integrate it out. And it's typically the lightest one that wins in any higher dimensional operator for which the mass is in the denominator. So this I did say before, but this is kind of a concrete example of where it just happens. The lightest mass wins in a denominator. I may forget to do this, so remind me if you're interested. But so in the gravity case, I don't know how to actually use that fact. In principle, there are things that are, if there are physical effects of loops of electrons, say, that are bigger than you would naively have guessed if you had said they were described by curvature cubed divided by the Planck mass squared. I've never found an example where that was big enough to be actually potentially even close to being observable. But I don't know that that's impossible. But there are examples, there are other examples of that happening in nature where, again, they're not measurable, but if you look at how neutrinos interact with light, let's say, they do interact at some level because in the standard model, the neutrinos couple to things like W bosons, which carry a charge, and so they couple to photons. And so there will, in the end of the day, at low energies, be some interactions that couple neutrinos to photons. And you can do if you guys want, this is one of the topics we could do. If you can go through an analysis like this and ask what's the dominant lowest energy contribution that describes the neutrino photon interactions. And the interesting thing is that if you look at, if I remember this right, if you look at how neutrinos couple to two photons, and you kind of you do the naive thing, you put in the factors of the W mass that are required on dimensional grounds, and the factors of the coupling constants you know are there, and the two pi's that have to be there, you do a pretty good job of estimating how big the coefficient is. But if you do the same thing for three photons, it turns out you get it wrong by many orders of magnitude, that you expect to find something which is much, much smaller than the real answer. And that's because that's another case of this general thing, that in the case of three photons, there's a contribution, there's a set of graphs for which it's the electron mass that plays the role of setting the scale rather than the W mass. And so instead of getting something like 1 over MW to the fourth, you get 1 over MW squared, 1 over M electron squared, which is much bigger than 1 over MW to the fourth. And so that's an example where by being careful about tracking where the light masses come in, it actually would, if you could measure photon neutrino scattering, which you can't, it would make an enormous difference in how strongly they interact. So it's not just in gravity this comes up. It's kind of a well-known thing that happens. In the case of the neutrinos and photons, the explicit calculation has been done, and so this effective field theory analysis is capturing something which you know to be true. And so that's an example which is, when we get to it, emphasizes that. But it also emphasizes the next thing you'd say if I say this is that why would we ever look at interactions which are suppressed by a bigger mass than the electron mass? So why do we not write down the electron mass for the weak interactions? And the story there is that if an interaction is breaking a symmetry, which is only broken by particles that are massive enough, then that symmetry can forbid the light particles from contributing. So it's worth your while to think about who's the lightest particle consistent with symmetries that dominate effective interactions, and that particular example will illustrate that point, if we get to it. First point. Second point is everything here, except for that term, is suppressed by at least one power of m electron. So if all we had was this term and this term, then we're just doing classical electromagnetism, and the only difference is that the Z is here, and that normally would be 1, but we can get rid of that by rescaling it into the gauge field. So if we take the gauge field, A mu goes to A mu divided by the square root of Z, we'll remove it from here, and we'll put it into here, and so that'll change the value of the charge, but nothing else. And so if you were to do, another thing you learn for free from this is that if you ask what are the corrections to classical electromagnetism, which is this term plus this term, you might have thought that what you're doing is a series in the fine structure constant, you know, alpha, e squared over 4 pi squared. And that's actually not true. The corrections to classical electromagnetism are all suppressed by energy divided by the electron mass squared, independent of what the value of alpha is. So if you're working at an accuracy where you're neglecting, your energies are so low that e squared over m squared are negligible, even if that's small enough that that would compete with alpha to the 15th power, it doesn't matter because the classical electromagnetism will be the exact answer up to the point that what you thought the charge is might be different. So there's an issue there as to defining exactly what the charge is, because that's where the Z went. It went into the value of the charge. But that's the only thing, the only way in which you know about these particles being there. So the corrections to classical E and M at low energies are controlled by at least one power of E squared over M E squared, except for the value. If you have some way of measuring the value of E, that's something which could be sensitive to the kinds of particles that are around. Electric charge. And so the thing that being emphasized here is, it is not a series in alpha. Not just a series. If you think of quantum electrodynamics as being graphs and you're exchanging photons and that's how you're reproducing the classical electrodynamics, it's tempting to think that there's a complicated graphs that you should be contributing, that you should be calculating, that are going to be, in the end of the day, modifications to electromagnetism. If you're looking for very precise statements about how the electromagnetic field reacts to classical currents, you might have thought that that's an exercise that you have to worry about calculating in powers of the fine structure constant. But the important thing is that all the corrections have at least one factor of E squared over M E squared in it. So if you're neglecting that, then what's left is not being corrected at all, which is a powerful statement. That's why Jackson is such a good book to read. What else could we say? So before going into this Z thing, which is kind of the important low energy residue of these fields, let me kind of switch, just because I was going to do this in the other order, but let me do this first. So let's talk about these terms, because we can dispense with them quickly before we go off in this long thing about what Z means. So supposing we were interested in something that these interactions contribute to, and so one thing that these would contribute to is the scattering of light by light. So in quantum electrodynamics, photons don't carry charge, so they don't directly scatter, but they do interact with electrons, and the electrons then can interact with other photons. And so if we worried about the scattering of light by light, at quantum electrodynamics, that could have happened through graphs like this, for example. So where you have an electron or a muon going around the loop and have photons on the outside. You might ask, what does that look like at low energies? So at low energies, it costs you, if you're at high enough energies, if you're at energies that are larger than, say, twice the electron mass, then you can pair produce particles, and the thing inside this loop could be a real thing. And you could also ask about the process where you start with photons and you end with electrons and positrons. But at low energies, where these things can't be produced yet, this has to be virtual, and so there has to be some effective description of it. And this is what these are going to describe for us. And so right away, our intuition should be that the scattering of light by light is going to be very weak at low energies, and it's going to go like powers of energy divided by the electron mass. And the amplitude should go like 4 powers of the electron mass, so the rate, which would be the amplitude squared, should go like 1 over 8 powers of the electron mass. And that's essentially right. There'll be factors of the fine structure constant as well. But you can very efficiently capture the low energy limit of this graph and the other ones. There's other graphs where you, you know, cross the photons. Eh? You can very efficiently capture that. The physics of that at low energies using these two terms. So let's work that through a little bit. So in QED, this is what gives you the scattering light by light. And energy is much less than electron mass. It's captured by the coefficients B and C over there. So that's an assertion I'm making, and it's very intuitive that it should be true, but we can check that. Suppose we really cared about the scattering light by light because we wanted to measure that to some great accuracy, what we'd really want to know is which operators in this expansion are relevant to which order in this 1 over electron mass squared story, and that would be that whole power counting thing that we've talked about. And so if it's true, intuitively, you're thinking that these interactions should be the dominant ones because they're the first things that involve 4 photons. But how do you know for sure that there's not an interaction involving something I haven't written here, which is going to contribute as large as this? Or if you wanted to work to subdominant order, if you do calculate the cross-section using these Bs and Cs, and you want to work at subdominant order in the small things, in this case, the fine structure constant and the electron mass, energy over electron mass, what are the other interactions you have to track? That's where the power counting comes in. And so if you look at our Lagrangian here, it has the same form that we were using when we did our power counting. So if we ask the question, which interactions in the Wilson action in which graphs contribute to the cross-section for gamma, gamma goes to gamma, gamma. Our answer is our power counting answer. So we look at E external lines, and as a function of the energy, external energy Q, and we had a general formula, which I want to write the way we wrote it before. So let me, I think I took that from these notes. So this went like F squared Q squared 1 over V to the E. We had a loop factor which was MQ over 4 pi F squared to twice the number of loops. Then we had Q over M to the sum of D minus 2 times V sub DK. And that was coming, if we had our Lagrangian, had the form of f to the fourth times sums of interactions that were built from fields divided by v, bosonic fields divided by v, and derivatives of fields divided by mv. And we actually have that form here. Let's forget all the muons for now. And so we have that form here where the bosonic field, this is a boson again, this has got a kinetic term which is 2 derivatives and 2 fields. If we take F and M and V all to be the electron mass, then this has that form, is the claim. So let's call this star, this formula. So star has this form with F equals V equals M electron. So that tells us in particular that if we, so this will go like m electron squared q squared 1 over m electron to the e times q over 4 pi m electron 2l q over m electron to the sum over d minus 2 v sub dk. But we also know that everywhere here, the electromagnetic field is appearing through F. So also, because A mu only, so A mu is the thing, think of phi being A mu, only enters, and you remember F mu nu is partial mu A nu minus partial nu A mu through F mu nu. This is happening because of the gauge invariance, that this whole Lagrangian had to be invariant under A mu goes to A mu plus their derivative of something. And because gauge invariance requires A to always appear through F, we know that every time we have a field, we're always going to have a derivative. We may have more derivatives than fields because things like this have, I could differentiate the Fs. We know that for every vertex, D is greater than or equal to K in the sense that there's more derivatives at, there's at least as many derivatives as there are fields in that vertex. And we also know that if we take things with two fields or for two derivatives, if I have two derivatives, I have to, by that rule, have two or fewer fields. There's at least two fields, so the only thing that has two derivatives is the one that has two fields, and that's the kinetic term. So if I'm counting interactions in this Feynman rule story, there's all these things that are appearing from the vertices have at least d equals 4. Okay, so also d equals 2, or consequently, d equals 2 implies that k is less than or equal to 2. But k is bigger than or equal to 2 because there's no invariant we can write down with 1 f mu nu in it. So the only d equals 2 term has k equals 2 and is the free Lagrangian. L naught equals minus 1/4 f mu nu, where is it? So we're not making vertices of these guys. These are things that were actually the, we made our propagators of those guys. So don't appear in vertices. So that means that for the purpose of this, we can always take, so for all vertices, d is bigger than or equal to 4. So again, this is always a positive power. And we can ask, what's the biggest contribution when e is equal to 4? So for e is equal to 4, because we're thinking of gamma gamma goes to gamma gamma, we're going to get that this is going to go like q squared over me squared q over 4 pi me And so then the question is, how do we minimize it? And it's the usual story that we minimize these powers by having L as small as possible and having this as small as possible. So the dominant piece will be L equals 0. And as small as possible, we can make it 0 if we were allowed to have D equals 2. But the point of this story was that there are no interactions with D equals 2. So the first contribution will come here when D is bigger than 2. And since D is even, I should also say because we're always having an even number of Fs, Because it's anti-symmetric, that means we're going to have an even number of d's to make it Lorentz invariant. So this means that the smallest that d can be here is 4, and then that means this sum is 2, provided we have v equals 1. So we have to have v 4k equals 1, v sub dk equals 0 for all d bigger than 4. And then subdominant would be, next to leading order would be L equals 1, V4K equals 1, VDK equals 0 for all D bigger than 4. Or L equals 0, and then we would allow ourselves to have sum of D minus 2, VDK is equal to 4. Then choose the Vs for that. And so on. Let's focus on this. And this is telling us kind of what we expected, that the only things we can do are to tree graphs with one vertex involving the thing with four derivatives. The thing with four derivatives has four fields, and that's these guys. So this says that the dominant contribution will be the Born approximation using these two interactions. And then the subleading ones would be the combinations you get from the second line there, that if you wanted to correct that, you should be including just tree graphs, but you want to do it, or you can try to do one loop graphs with just these guys, and that's not possible with only one of them, because each vertex has four legs on it. You want to end with only four legs, and if you want to make a loop, then you need to have at least two vertices. So there's no way to satisfy the L equals one case. So then the only thing is you could do Born approximation with something here involving, say, six derivatives, or two things involving four derivatives, if you can draw the graph that does that. So if you just do the so what we'd expect then is that the amplitude should go like, in this minimum case, this is 0 and this is 2. And so the amplitude should go like q to the fourth over me to the fourth. This is the leading. And that means that the cross-section should go like q over me to the eighth. And so we can compare that to the real answer. So what we can do is, so to get the factors and two and stuff, what we have to actually do is just do the Feynman graph using the Feynman rules for these interactions. So if you do the real calculation, which I just want to quote because I want to compare it to this expectation. So the real calculation, what happens is that if you take that graph at the low energy limit of this graph, will be the case where it's actually much easier to calculate that box graph in the low energy limit where the external momenta are zero than it is in the general case where there's momentum flowing through the graph. And that git calculation tells you what the value of B and C are. And it turns out that when you do that, the answer you get is simple. So in QED, the box graph, so you remember our rules are, we identify what interactions we need. If we have the full theory, we calculate the relevant coefficients in the full theory. In this case, we've identified that the coefficients we need are B and C. So we go off to the full theory and calculate B and C by evaluating that box graph, but only in the zero momentum limit. And the answer when we do that is that B is equal to 4/7 C and equal to alpha squared over 90. The alpha squared you can get because, you know, just by eye, we had four interactions there, each of which had an E in it. So we had E to the fourth from the coupling constants. And we had a loop. And each loop costs us, in the same kind of an argument, we get a 4 pi squared for the fact that it's at one loop in QED, and that's and alpha is by definition e squared over 4 pi. So you can kind of see that the alpha squared is just essentially that. The 90 you have to work at. So the alpha is just the loop factor in QED. So that's what B and C turn out to be from QED. And then if you calculate the cross-section using these interactions and putting in the value of B and C that I just gave you, then you get that the cross-section for gamma gamma goes to gamma gamma turns out to be, so let me give you the differential cross-section as a function of solid angle. It's 139 over 4 pi squared alpha squared over 90 squared. And you're not surprised to see that factor because you're going to get a b squared and a c squared coming from taking the amplitude from those. The amplitude will be some linear combination of b and c. Then you'll square it to get the rate. And that's where this factor is going to come from. Times the center mass energy to the 6th power divided by the electron mass to the 8th power times 3 plus cosine squared theta squared. And the thing that you've neglected are the subdominant terms. We know that the next thing that we're not including are suppressed by at least 1 power of energy squared center mass over m electron squared. So we know how big the corrections are not powers of alpha, they're powers of this, possibly in addition to powers of alpha. But there's no corrections to this, to any power of alpha that don't also come with a power of, actually, I'm lying to you there, sorry. If you wanted to know the corrections to this in powers of alpha, you'd have to calculate the corrections. The total story as powers of alpha is the corrections to B and C as powers of alpha, which would come from loop graphs with more photons stuck in the box graph there. So you could get corrections to this prediction here. So this should have been plus order alpha cubed, say. But this kind of identifies which graphs you'd have to calculate. It's the ones that are correcting B and C. Yeah, this is the simplest way to get this. This has actually been done both ways. You can either do this by doing the whole thing and then taking the low energy limit, and it looks like this. That's the hard way because it's a complicated function before you do that. But the simple way to get this is just to take the Feynman rules from these two interactions as a function of B and C and calculate them, and you get an answer proportional to B plus linear combination of B and C squared. Put in this number for B and C, and then they agree in the cross-section at low energies. This is the angle of the scattering. What else do you need to know? And again, this underlines that the general argument didn't tell you what the energy was. I just took them all to be the same size. But this is showing you that what's appearing as the energy is the center mass energy, like it was true in the graviton scattering case. And that's a Lorentz invariant quantity, that all observers agree on the center mass energy, because that's the energy, that's something you can define in terms of the scattering particles themselves. And so when the energy expansion, when you calculate something which is, if we did the cross-section, that would have been Lorentz invariant. If it has a low energy expansion, it'll have to be a low energy expansion of a Lorentz invariant thing, notion of energy divided by the mass, and it turns out in practice to be things like the center mass energy. And it's doing all the things you would have. This factor you couldn't have gotten just by these general arguments, but you see that these factors and these factors are coming for free. This one actually you can get it a long ways towards too by keeping track of the polarizations and the scattering. But the business end of the size of this thing is really these two factors, which are obvious from this argument because this power just came from the counting of energies, and then this power came from the fact that these coefficients are arising at order alpha squared. On dimensional grounds, the cross-section is an energy, is a length squared, so it's 1 over energy squared. And that dimension is being set by the center mass energy. So the missing thing here, this is telling you the amplitude, but then there's a phase-space integral you're going to do, and that's set by the center mass energy, the range of integration. So that you could think of this as being e to the 8th over m to the 8th times 1 over e squared coming from the center mass, coming from the phase-space integral. This is the unpolarized, yeah, right. If you did the polarized one, it's actually a little bit simpler because the way to think about that one is that it's easier to think about this in terms of, instead of F and F dual, think about it as being the self-dual part and the anti-self-dual part. If you write it as in terms of F plus F dual squared or F minus F dual squared, with an I in there probably. because those are the things that carry the self-dual and the anti-self-dual parts of F are the ones that describe the particles of specific helicity, plus one or minus one, and they can't interfere. So this rate comes to you as a sum of two squares, which is the rate, which is the built out of the F, the self-dual one alone, and the one with the anti-self-dual one alone. And so that part you could actually write down without, in terms of B and C, without knowing. I've done a step here where I've combined the answer in terms of B and C without knowing what the value of B and C, what they were, has a cleaner form, which is the sum of the two polarizations. And that has the angular dependence in it. So the... because there's no, because the you're doing an amplitude where you're specifying, say, the polarizations of the photons, and the if the polarizations are different, then the amplitudes won't interfere. If you have all plus, say, polarizations and all minus. So the thing is that the thing you normally worry about is you have several graphs that they, when you have to add them and then square them. But in these cases where the graphs are differing by what you're labeling the states by, then you have to square them separately and add them. And in the case of polarization, that's what happens. And so it makes it particularly simple to do because you've got one graph squared plus another graph squared rather than sums that are interfering. And then the angular dependence is dictated to you by angular momentum conservation and helicity together so that you can get a lot of, except for the numerical factor, you can actually do a lot of this without knowing what the value of B and C are. Okay. All right, so that's all I want to say about photon-photon scattering, but it's again, the main messages are it's doing what the graviton did. It's organizing things, lightest mass wins. It's much simpler than doing the real calculation. In this case, it's not measurable, really. It's not a big deal, but it's we're going to come to the case of neutral particles scattering from light scattering from a neutral object, like a dust molecule. And you're probably used to that calculation because that's Rayleigh scattering or Thompson scattering, where you actually calculate. That's Rayleigh scattering, I guess, where you calculate, from a charge distribution and it's neutral, but it's polarizable, and then the photon can scatter from the charges inside the molecule or whatever it is, and then scatter away from it. And you, when you do that calculation, you work a little bit, and you see that at low energies, it goes like energy to the fourth power. And that's the story as to why the sky is blue, right? That the scattering of light from neutral things like molecules and dust goes like energy to the fourth power. And so it blue scatters more than red does. And so if you look to the side, it's the blue light that's being scattered. That energy dependence, you're not going to be surprised to find there's a very simple way to get that, just with a no-brainer way of doing it in terms of effective interactions. And so that's a case where, unlike these cases we've looked at so far, the actual thing that you're calculating has been measured, and it's not such an academic exercise. But to do that, when we have to talk about how we describe dust in these things. But actually, I shouldn't make it sound like it's mysterious. There'll be some operator describing the dust density, but then the electromagnetic field will have to appear with Fs, and so the first thing will be F squared. So you'll have something involving the dust times F mu, and then the amplitude has two derivatives in it. So then the rate has four derivatives in it, and that's why it goes like energy to the fourth power. So it's like a stupidly easy argument if you do the effective low energy answer. But it's, again, low energies are simple if you think about the energy expansion early. Okay, so let's go back to, unless there's questions with that, let's go back to Z. So I guess we're in four. So at zeroth order, sole influence of virtual and mu plus and mu minus and everybody is in Z. So the only thing we can write down at the dimension 4 level, which is zeroth order in 1 over mu, is minus 1/4 Z F mu plus E not A mu, J mu. And so Z here was evaluated by calculating graphs like this, where we have electrons here. Uh, So the analog of the calculation that gives us B and C over here for Z is one that was a little bit more subtle because it diverged. And remember, last class I gave you what the answer was. So Z turns out to be 1 minus alpha over 3 pi, 1 over epsilon plus a number plus log of m electron squared over mu squared. And here, this was evaluating it using dimensional regularization, where n was 4 minus 2 epsilon. That's what the epsilon was. So as epsilon goes to 0, that's n goes to 4. That's the divergence. And k was explicitly just some number. And I just to show that it's concrete, I wanted to write it down. And it's the Euler-Mascheroni constant and 4 pi's. Where did I write that down? Wasn't that annoying? I had that. I can't see it here, but you remember it's. I wrote it down last time explicitly. So it's a combination of Euler, Mascheroni, and log of 4 pi. Okay, thanks. So this is the Euler-Mascheroni. And mu is, remember it came to us because the electrodes, I should have said this here, that d mu is partial mu plus I e a mu. And that gauge, that coupling constant was dimensionless in four dimensions if we went through the exercise of keeping track of the Lagrangian's dimensions and the field dimensions, and we could figure out the dimension of the coupling constant, and it was dimensionless in four dimensions, but in n dimensions, which we are in dimensional regularization, it was not dimensionless. And so what we did was we wanted to count E as being dimensionless in all dimensions, and so we put in a factor of a scale, arbitrary scale mu, to compensate for that. So E was, let me call this E naught hat. So E naught hat is E naught times mu, I think it was to the epsilon. So this has dimensions of mass to the epsilon, and we wanted E naught to always be dimensionless, and so when epsilon goes to zero, they're the same, but in general dimensions are not the same. And that was important because mu shows up in answers, because once you start evaluating things that are functions of dimension and you expand them near epsilon equals zero, you would have thought that you wouldn't have to care about this because epsilon is going to go to zero. But once you start having things that are going like 1 over epsilon, then things that were finite as epsilon went to zero when multiplied by a pole, you have to go to order epsilon in the finite thing, and the order epsilon term can hit the pole and give you something which is finite, and that's kind of where this kind of thing is coming from. If you expand this to order epsilon, there's a log of mu in it, and it hits the pole, and so you pick off this log of mu from that kind of a thing. And so that tells you that the coefficient of the log mu is related to the coefficient of the pole, because they're arising, this is arising because the pole was there. And you also know that nothing can depend on mu, because the way it's being introduced is as an arbitrary scale, and so nothing physical can ever depend on it. Good. So what do we do? Well, that's kind of looks like it's a mess. It's divergent. But the thing is that we want to this E is not the thing that we measure. We measure E by taking some charge distribution and actually asking what kind of forces does it give rise to, what kind of electric fields it gives rise to. And so normally, what that would mean is that we would normally write Maxwell's equations with a one here. That would be where the Lagrangian is e squared minus b squared, so that would give you the standard Maxwell equations. And so we can absorb this z into a redefinition of the fields. So what we'll do is we'll absorb z into a mu by rescaling. A mu goes to a mu divided by the square root of z. And so when we do that, z times f mu nu, we'll just go to f mu nu times f mu nu. So let's put in the minus 1/4. And this is the canonical form. That's what we have always been doing. We've been taking, whenever we had a scalar field, we always wrote its kinetic term as 1/2 d mu phi d mu phi. And if it didn't come to us that way, we could always scale the field to make it true. And what's happening here is we start off normally, conventionally in the full theory, we start off with the coefficient of f mu nu being equal to 1/4, because that's the conventional form. That's the one for which the path integral is being weighted by a unit weight. That's the thing that we're assuming is dominating the path integral. And now we integrate out the electron and we no longer have that form, but we can always go back to that form by scaling the correction into f. So it was normalized and now we have to renormalize it. And that's where the word comes from. And so this is what we're going to do. And I guess we want to, we don't want to divide by z. I should have actually, when I write this formula, oh no, actually I'm good, yeah. The one here was what was there before. The alpha thing is what came from this graph. So there was, again, this graph had two factors of the coupling constant for each vertex, and then it was a loop, so it had a 4 pi squared. For the same reason, we got 4 pi squares over there. And that is alpha over 4 pi. So that you can kind of see that this factor, up to the factor of 4/3, had to be what it was. So this, it's this term which came from the loop, and this is the thing we had already. So given that, then what I'm doing here is fine. But once we do that, if all we had was this, then that would mean that there's no content to this. We wouldn't really care that this was there. The reason we're going to care is that photons actually interact with things, and that's why I've been carrying around this current term, this term here. When we rescale z out of that, it reappears here. So our new, if I call this, let's call this the renormalized field. Our new Lagrangian will be minus 1/4 by construction. This is the, but now we'll have a piece here which is E naught over the square root of z times AR mu. And so it's everywhere the E was appearing, now that's what's going to appear. So it's tempting to call this E physical or E renormalized. I'm not calling it E renormalized because there's going to be more than one way to renormalize things. The point of what I'm about to say is, before we get into the details, is there's many ways to renormalize things. And there's several schemes that are come up often. One of them is called the physical scheme, physical renormalization scheme, which is essentially what I'm about to talk about now. And it has the advantage that the parameters that you're talking about have a simple physical interpretation. But it has a disadvantage, which will be that the mu dependence of the, it has a disadvantage that it's less useful for making an argument that people often make, the renormalization group argument, which I will also make later on. And for that argument, it's more useful to use what's called minimal subtraction, where you just subtract, the definition is that you just subtract these terms and forget the logarithm. So you just subtract the pole. Minimal subtraction says subtract the pole and that's it. And modified minimal subtraction subtracts the pole and this extra constant. And that's useful for another reason. And I'd like to contrast those two ways of renormalizing to emphasize that it doesn't matter how you renormalize, but it's like Weinberg's second rule of theoretical physics that you can use any variables you like to solve a problem, but if you use the wrong ones, you'll be sorry. So there's some ways of renormalizing make some things easy and other ways make other things easy. And there's two particular ways that are worth tracking because they come up often. So if we define this physical, this is what we would call, say, the renormalized physical renormalization scheme. It's physical in the sense that if we now calculate with this theory, everything we would have calculated with classical electromagnetism, we're going to get what we got in classical electromagnetism because it's the same theory. It's just that we're going to have this number is the number that will appear everywhere the charge appeared. And so if we measured that number by, say, measuring the strength of a Coulomb force from a given charge, this is the number we'd measure, is this thing here. So this is the one, when someone tells you that alpha physical is E physical squared over 4 pi, if they tell you that that's 1 over 137 point something, 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 because they've measured some feature of atoms at low energies, this is the thing they're telling you. This is they're telling you the value of this quantity here, not the value of E naught. E naught is actually implicitly something which is infinite because it depends on things like this pole in such a way that it cancels the pole that was in Z to give you something which is the thing you measured. And the magic of renormalization is that all the divergences that you get in graphs have this property that they can be removed by redefining the things in your problem. And the things, and you only have a finite number of things in your problem. In this case, we have the electric charge of the electron, electric charge E, and we have the rescaling of the fields. If we had also kept the electron, we would also have the rescaling of the electron field and its mass. But everything gets absorbed into those things, is the statement. All right, so far so good. So I want to contrast that with another renormalization scheme. And that's the one I was alluding to, the minimal subtraction. And the, yeah.
So this way, I think we have to appreciate more non-renormalized theory more than renormalized theory. Because when you are, for example, around the electron mass, and then you dial up energy, so QED doesn't care that how much you go up, no? Even if you are around the mass of the muon. But I think about the Fermi theory, so it cares. I mean, you have a lot of problems when you go near the mass of, for example, W boson or Z boson.
Right, right. You're thinking that, if I try to it cares in the sense that, say, unitarity would fail or something. If I calculate the cross section for fermion scattering near the W boson mass, the cross sections would be sick at some level.
So I mean that technically, QED doesn't tell you that muon mass exists or not. Muon exists or not.
It's actually more of a, it's less of a qualitative issue than that. It's more of a quantitative issue. The difference between renormalizable and non-renormalizable is that in a non-renormalizable theory, you're being told that you're explicitly getting things that are powers of energy divided by some scale, and so you see that when the energy is equal to that scale, something's going to go wrong, because that series is a bad approximation.
Even in QED?
In QED, what happens is it's a special case where you're working to zeroth order in that ratio, and so you don't see what the scale is, but it's true that everything now becomes logarithm. So that what happens is that QED also fails, but the place where it has to fail, the place where it's forced to fail is exponentially large in energy, but it's still there. In QED's case, what happens is that when we get to the running of the coupling, you'll see that the running hits a pole at some point, but it's at a pole, which is because things are running logarithmically, it's a pole that happens at exponentially large values of energy, but it does happen eventually. So you would not believe that QED is the theory for all energies, because eventually it is sick. It's just sick at a much higher scale than the non-renormalizable theories are. So they all have the property that they're low energy approximation, but the renormalizable ones, It's the place where things have to fail is, it seems like it could be very far away. You don't really know how far away it is because it's only depending logarithmically on the scale. So it's the only difference really is that quantitative statement about the logarithmic dependence rather than power law dependence.
So does muon play a role in this?
In logarithms it does. So what happens in the case of QED is that QED just with electrons, in principle, could have made sense up to some place like up near the Planck scale where you hit the place where the coupling constant becomes infinite because of the running. But what happens in practice is you actually hit the muon well before that. So the fact that there is a scale there, and it did appear in higher order interactions like the 1 over mu squared to the fourth contribution to light-to-light scattering is really there in QED with muons. And the effective theory with electrons only sees it because there's an F mu squared term with a 1 over mu squared in front of it. So in QED with electrons, the electron component is coming from that graph, but the muon component is again coming from this operator with a muon in it. So there are operators with 1 over mu's in them, but if you chose not to look at the 1 over mu terms, then what you've done is you've hidden from yourself most of the ways that you would see that there's something happening in mu. But it's so that means that you would have naively been able to extrapolate that theory up to higher energies than mu. But in real life, what happens is that it actually gets intercepted at mu by the theory with muons in it.
So you mean that the only way that we understand is to go to for example, LHC and see that your result doesn't match with
right.
So this is the only way that we can understand that.
For normalizable theories, yeah. Because
for non-normalizable theory, you technically understand that there is something wrong with when we develop the energy.
It's more for non-randomizable theories. It's more in your face that things are problems are gonna hit you at much lower energies than you would have thought. You know, for non-randomizable theories, the way you think about it now is that renormalizable theories are the ones for which you're imagining that the ratio of the high scale and the low scale is so small that you can work to zeroth order in it, and then because you're working to zeroth order in that ratio, you don't see the ratio anymore. So that means that the theory you're working with, it's not so obvious where it's going to fail. It eventually typically does fail. And so in the case of the QED, it fails because the couplings become strong at the Landau pole. But the thing is that because it's an effective theory, it has to capture all possible things that could have had a photon in it. So you could have imagined a world where nothing happened up to the Planck scale. And then that effective theory had to capture that physics. And so it makes sense up to the Planck scale. But in the real world, it happens that something else happens way before the Planck scale. And so distinguishing those options, you have to actually do the experiments to see what's going on. If you are working to an accuracy that you actually know that that physics that you see in experiments is being described by non-normalizable interactions, then it's easier because you actually know what the denominator is. And it's still true that you may be being misled a little bit. Because in the weak interactions, for instance, the thing that you see at low energies is G Fermi times fermion, 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 or something like that. That's describing the weak decays. And G Fermi is one, it's 246 GeV to the minus 2 in the units I'm using. And it turns out that G Fermi over root 2 is the coupling constant of the SU2 in the standard model divided by MW squared. And there's a factor here which is 2 or 8 or something like that, some numerical factor, which if I write it down, I'll get it wrong, but it's some number. And the thing is MW is 80 GeV, and they're different. Those scales are different because of these factors of G and 2 and stuff like that. So in practice, the scale, if all you knew at low energies with the weak interactions, you'd think, well, something has to happen before 246 GeV. In this case, it wasn't so much different from 246 GeV, but it was a little bit different. And that was to do with the details of what the theory was. And so you have some advantage that when you have a coupling which has dimensions, it's kind of telling you what you're comparing your energy to. But it's not telling you exactly what you're comparing it to, because there's factors that are also nothing to do with masses that are in there as well. And it just all that's happening for the renormalizable case is that your coupling is dimensionless, so the scale is actually there, but it's hidden in this renormalization through logarithms. And so it naively it's not there because things look like they're dimensionless, but it really is hidden in there. But the place where you'd be pointing to as a place where things are failing is actually very high. And it may be that something else happens, but things have to fail before you get to that point, but they may fail before you get to that, well before you get to that point. And that'll depend on exactly which theory nature is realized.
Is it possible to see that renormalizable theory is going to fail, like just by looking? Because with the non-renormalizable theory, you can see, for example, that your physical quantities start to depend explicitly on whatever cutoff you use, right?
No, I would say that the non-renormalizable thing, there's a sense in which everything is just renormalizable in a trivial way. So the what would normally, when people say that say this is not renormalizable, what they would mean is that if I take all the ultraviolet divergences I get by these interactions, and if I try and renormalize them only with E and Z, then it doesn't work. So that's like for gravity saying that, can I put all the divergences into the Newton's constant and rescaling the metric. And that's not possible. But we saw when we did the power counting that if I do loops in gravity, I can renormalize all the divergences at the one loop into the Newton's constant, the scaling of the metric, and in the coefficients of the curvature squared terms. And at two loops, I can put it into those things plus the curvature cubed terms. But you, every loop, you need more and more terms. But you have more and more terms if you have this the whole non-renormalizable interaction. The mistake would be to stop somewhere. And so then what people would have said is that that's not predictive now, because now all those coefficients I have to get from experiments because I can't predict them because they're infinite. And so I need an infinite number of experiments, and so how can I make any progress? And the fallacy there was that you had to have arbitrarily accurate predictions. And so if you only say that you're going to predict to 1% or to one part in a million, then that means in practice you're only going some finite number of terms out in that series. And the thing you might not have been aware of, but what you were doing was you were doing a series in energy divided by some scale, and you only have to go to some fixed order in that series to get the accuracy you want. And at that order, everything's predictive again, because there's only a finite number of terms that you have to figure out from experiment. As long as you have more observables than that, you can predict things, just like you could for renormalizable theories.
Right, but so from looking at that, you can see pretty clearly that eventually, like, if my procedure to get, my procedure for one particular energy will not work for a higher energy. Like, I would need to include more terms because the series in E over M
right.
is eventually going to fail.
So here you know that if once E was bigger than this, you're not hoping anything can ever possibly work because you're doing a series in E divided by that, and that's one.
So is there any way to see like that for QED just from how physical parameters? Like you talk about the running
of there is.
The running of a bare parameter.
Let me finish this thing because I'm about to do it, and the thing is I haven't done it yet. But it's the essence of how, so the question you're asking is, and you're asking also is so it may be that nature intercepts the effective theory at some point, but the effective theory might have been consistent to higher energies than it. The self-consistency of the effective theory, the domain of self-consistency of the effective theory might be bigger than the actual range in which nature gives you the effective theory before something else kicks in. And the way you normally see the self-consistency issue is you see the series, one of your approximations starts to fail. And if you're doing a non-renormalizable theory, then the approximation that typically fails is this energy divided by this scale. So it's kind of obvious that it's failing. But the way people often phrase that is they'll say that you calculate the unitarity, you calculate a cross-section for something like this, and it goes like a power of energy, but there's a general unitarity bound. So unitarity normally requires the energy, the cross-section as a function of energy has to be less than a power of logarithm of energy to some power. I can't remember what the power is, but it's, so something growing like a power of energy is going to eventually beat this. And it's going to beat it when the energy is of the order of the thing you're comparing it to. And so the way it's often said is that you're getting a unitarity failure in your theory. But what that really means, if you think about unitarity is saying that, the evolution was unitary, that the time evolution operator was some unitary thing, so probability didn't get ruined. And we're always talking about, Hermitian Lagrangians, so they're going to have Hermitian Hamiltonians. How could unitarity ever possibly fail? If I take exponentials of a Hermitian thing, it's always unitary. And what's really happening is if you could have calculated in this theory accurately what the evolution was, it would be unitary because the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. But what's happening is that your approximation that you're making to calculate your cross-section is failing. And so this formula is actually the wrong formula. It's not what you would have gotten by exponentiating the Hermitian Hamiltonian. And so it's always true that although people say it's a unitarity problem, what they're really saying is that there's an approximation you're making which is breaking down, and it's usually this low energy approximation that's breaking down. And the fact that this is being violated is an obvious flag that something has gone wrong. And if you kind of track what was it that went wrong, it's essentially you're doing a series here. And that was the thing that went wrong. But in the case of QED, what's going to happen is the same thing. An approximation will fail. But what will happen now is that the coupling constant here, E, is it going to be a function of energy? And so if you go to high enough energies, the coupling constant is becoming 1. And so again, it's the approximations are going to fail. But it's going to be at a very, very high energy because the energy dependence of this coupling constant will be logarithmic now. But it's the same logic exactly. It's just that the dependence on this energy is much weaker, and so it's a much dramatically higher scale. But it's exactly the same logic that an approximation that you needed to infer the properties of your theory is breaking down.
Sorry, at what energy does it happen?
It happens at, you'll see it in a second. It's exponentially large compared to the mass of the electron.
So it means that the theory of electron and photon does not understand that muon exists.
Right. If that meant this term and this term, period. But it would eventually, no one can believe that that's the theory of the world right up to infinite scales, because that theory eventually does break down at higher energies. And you might say, well, maybe it becomes strongly coupled and that's still the right theory, but you have to figure it out. It's just harder to do. And that might be true, but there's no evidence that it's true. That's the amazing thing about string theory. That's the first time someone handed you a theory which in principle could have made sense to arbitrarily high energies. And so that may not be the way nature works, but we've never had a theory where that was even possible. And so that's why people take it so seriously, is that once you have a theory that could be the theory for all energies, you better understand that one, because that's, we've never been able to explore the issues that you'd like to explore with a theory like that. So.
In the case that your coupling doesn't diverge like that, if it's like asymptotically free, I've heard people say that you could take that to be a fundamental theory, but I don't.
So the words there would be, that's like essentially a renormalizable theory. The thing I was pointing to as a problem with QED is that the coupling gets stronger, but if it gets weaker, then you're not being forced to the point where that coupling is getting strong. And so you could say, well, it's self-consistently, none of the things you thought were small are getting large as you go to higher energy. So it's better than it would be for QED. That's true. But it's still true, though, that there are divergences in QED. So the thing is that it's still true that you would have to say that there are some QCD. There are some things in the Lagrangian that you can't predict because they're sensitive. If you wanted to actually predict the value of the coupling constant, you'd have to know what the physics was at the high scale. And it's true that it's not very sensitive, but it does depend on it at some level. If you did try to make the new physics scale infinitely high, then it would be true that things are infinite. And that, you know, the argument that says an effective theory you can only follow finite numbers of terms is assuming that the scale, the new physics scale, is some finite scale, large but finite, and you're comparing your energy to that. But if it really was infinitely high, then you have to work arbitrarily accurately, and then it really is true that you're not predictive, because you need all infinite numbers of terms in your series. So if someone gives you a theory which is renormalizable, and it's asymptotically free, then you would have said that, so you're not very sensitive, you're only logarithmically sensitive to some high scale, and so you can put it off for a long ways, but eventually, if you want to predict all the values of the constants in your nature, you do need to know what's going on at the high scales. So it can't be the end of the world, it can't be the last theory we have, but it could be one that describes everything for a long ways. And that's, for gravity, all you would actually want to, that's all you should really expect to have for gravity is a theory of the Planck scale. All you'd really ask for it to be is renormalizable, because then you're just saying whatever is going on above the Planck scale is long enough off that I can understand the Planck scale by itself. And the amazing thing was that was actually hard to do, but the first example of a renormalizable theory turned out to be finite. And so what's special about string theory is that it's finite, so you don't actually need to know anything about anything at higher energies beyond string theory to predict everything. And so that's the first time that you have an example where you can really predict everything. But people often talk about asymptotically safe theories, which are kind of not the same as asymptotically free. And there, what they're saying is that it's like renormalizable is as good as it gets. So they're saying that it could be true that gravity is like QCD in the sense that QCD has the property that you go to very high energies and there's a couple constants you can't predict, but you can predict everything else in terms of them. So the QCD coupling constant at some scale has to be given to you, but after that you're in business. And so what they say for gravity is that it might be true that as you go to very high energies, all the possible, all these many non-renormalizable interactions, you've got a many-dimensional coupling constant space there for all the coefficients of these non-renormalizable interactions. It might be that as you flow up to high energies, you go onto some low-dimensional surface. Like if you went onto a line, like one, if only one coupling ever ran in coupling constant space, then that would be the thing that you'd need to know. You couldn't predict where you were on that line in coupling constant space. But if you knew if someone gave you that value, you could predict everything else at low energies. And that's kind of like a renormalizable theory, because that's as predictive as a renormalizable theory would be. You have some finite, small number of things you'd have to fix from experiment, and then after that, you predict everything else at low energies.
Okay, so you're saying that the effective Lagrangian would look like, it wouldn't look like gravity, but it would just have a finite number of
That's a hypothesis they have. Yeah. Yeah. So they think that's what I think Weinberg did this. If you extrapolated, the power of renormalizability was really that you had at very high energies some small number of things you had to specify, and then after that everything was a prediction. So he kind of just made the speculation that maybe it's true in these superficially non-renormalizable theories that happens. And if that's true, then that would be a good thing. And then there's this discussion as to whether or not there is any evidence that happens or not. And
okay, but when people say take the coupling to infinity type of thing,
that's not the coupling, but the scale.
The cutoff to infinity,
yeah.
That's sort of...
They're basically saying, what they're in practice saying in the language I'm using is that they're taking it to be arbitrarily high enough that you can drop all powers of the scale you're interested in divided by that. But logarithms you might be worried about. I would say that renormalizability and asymptotic safety, if it exists, would be good things, but they're not as good as finite. And so the fact that there exists finite theories is amazing. And people didn't believe they did exist until the 80s. All right, another normalization scheme. So the simplest one is if your goal is to get rid of the pole, is just subtract the pole. So let's talk about two other. So one is a minimal subtraction. So what we would do is we define E. Let's define Z pole to be 1 minus alpha over 3 pi epsilon. And then we'll just find E minimal subtraction to be E naught over Z minimal subtraction. Let's write this as minimal subtraction. And then as soon as you've done that, then it's hard to stop the modified. Yes, thank you. Ah, I bet coins. Good catch. All right, so modified minimal subtraction. That's called MS bar. It's just 1 minus alpha over 3 pi, 1 over epsilon plus k. If you're going to subtract an infinite thing, you can always subtract a finite thing with it. And all these different schemes, all these different renormalization schemes just differ by the basic observation that if you're allowed to subtract an infinite thing, then nothing can stop you from, you know, how do you unambiguously identify the infinite thing? You can always add a finite thing to the infinite thing, and that's still infinite. So the ambiguity is another way of saying that these parameters, you know, the fact that they diverge means that there's an ambiguity to them. You have to get their value from something, and typically you'll get it from experiment. All right. So this is probably a good place to stop. So where we're going to go in the afternoon is the question is, so why would you do this? What's the advantage of doing this? And so the zeroth order answer is, you know, life is really easy if you do that because it's very simple to track the effects of this. Since Z is coming to you in this way, and you're kind of subtracting off the obvious thing, it's actually very simple to track what the coupling constant is doing. But there's actually a more useful. The real reason people do this is not just that, and so the real reason is that you're going to see that the I guess you can see it already, that I can always take any of these things and relate them to this physical thing, right? This is the one that somebody's gone out and measured, and the experimentalists will tell you the value for. But if you know the value for this, then you can figure out the values for these guys. So E MS bar, for example, is going to be equal to, it's E naught over the square root of Z MS bar. So that means it's going to be E physical times the square root of Z, what did I call it there? Z, I just call it Z over, let's call this, give it a name, Z physical. Since I'm now making I'm distinguishing various kinds of choices for Z. And so this, if I write it out in powers of alpha, right, this is going to be, this is 1 minus alpha over 3 pi, 1 over epsilon plus k plus log of, actually, all I really care about is 1 over epsilon plus dot, dot, dot. And then I'm going to have to divide by this, and I guess there's a factor of 2 because I took the square root. That'll be 6. But then it'll be plus alpha over 6 pi. And then ZMS bar, I have this. So I have 1 over epsilon plus k. And so the important thing is you know that the epsilons are canceling here. So if I, that kind of makes sense. The way I was supposed to interpret the divergences was that since this is diverging, I have to think of E naught diverging. But the whole point of this ratio was that I got something which was no longer diverging. And that's true for this, and for that. So if I can compare them directly with each other, the divergence is gone. So there's some straightforward, this is a finite relationship between this and this. But the point is that I should have actually kept writing this. This is plus k plus the logarithm of m over mu squared, I guess. This is a number that experimentalists will tell you is 1 over 137. And so if you ask where did the mu dependence go, it must be that this is something which is finite but mu dependent, because the mu dependence did not cancel here, right? So this would be 1 minus alpha over 6 pi ln of m squared over mu squared. Let me make sure I got that factor right. So what are you supposed to think about the mu dependence? Since this is physical, oh, I forgot here, this is a, E phys should be in front of this whole thing. Since this is a physical number, it must be that this is a mu dependent number. So the bottom line is that E MS bar should be thought of as a function of this mu. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, nothing physical can depend on mu. That's what I told you at the very beginning, that's true. But this is not something physical. This is something which is just a parameter we're using to keep track of this number that we got to choose in the Lagrangian, which is really this number in disguise. So what has to happen is if we calculate something else, like let's say we calculate electron scattering or something, we do anything else we want to calculate, if we calculate it as a function of this, then the mu dependence that's hidden in E has to cancel a mu dependence that came elsewhere, such that the answer is finite and mu independent once expressed in terms of physical things like this. So the main message will be that this thing we're defining, although it's finite, it depends on mu, and it's not just an experimental number, but it's something which we can infer for a given mu from physical things like the measured value of the strength of electric repulsion of two charges or something. And it's useful, so the message is that it's going to be really useful to track the mu dependence of this coupling. That's where the energy dependence came from. So when I tell you what the, it's just one line here to write out what the mu dependence is. But it's also true that the, you might say, why do I care what this mu dependence is? And that's because when you calculate physical things, the physical processes typically have large logarithms in them. And those large logarithms can be efficiently identified and kept track of by keeping track of this mu dependence. So it's actually very useful to know what this mu dependence is. And it's harder to do that. So the utility of this scheme is that it allows you to very efficiently track large logarithms. The utility of the physical scheme is that it's giving you things in terms of numbers that you measure in an experiment. And so the what I'll do in the afternoon is kind of finish that thought. But also, you're going to see that if we now put the muon back in, the minimal subtraction is going to have this thing run. It's going to get a contribution. This contribution came from the running of the electron in that loop over there. But this minimal subtraction will see we'll see all charged particles in your theory, no matter how massive they are, because nowhere in here was there a mass of anything except inside this logarithm. And so there's a more, there's an even more useful version of this of this minimal subtraction called decoupling subtraction, where you define it so that in energies above the muon mass, it sees the running due to the electron and the muon, but then below the muon mass, it only sees the running of the electron, and below the electron mass, it doesn't run. So where we're going to go is, this is useful for summing large logarithms in a way that I haven't described yet, but I will. And this is kind of useful in the obvious way that it's the thing that you measure, and so ultimately you're going to want to express things in terms of that. And there's a intermediate choice that's halfway between this and this, which is useful when you're trying to track the influence of many heavy particles and how couplings run, how logarithms of heavy masses appear in answers if you have more than one of them. So that's where we're going to go.